The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Premier League, where pre-Christmas games actually do bring penalties. We salute Salah's spot-kick supremacy, but reckon the Wolves' handball call was actually the pits. Plus, other bold conclusions on the weekend's action. Are Watford due for a new manager? Have Newcastle had their one win all season? And from our severe on-field stuffings department, what's with Betis fans throwing their toy animals on the pitch? We'll discuss that and much, much more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Well then, listener, thank you for joining us for this edition of the Totally Football Show. As we sit here, it is Monday the 13th of December. Daniel Storey is here with us. Hey, Daniel.
Hi, James.
Also, Dan Bardell.
Hello, James.
Sorry, what was that? Can't make it out with that accent.
I'll tell you what, we'll come on to it, I'm sure, but I know that journalist and I don't understand what he says.
No, fair enough. That was, sorry, there's slightly oblique reference to Jurgen Klopp's post-match moment in the Liverpool-Villa game. Also here, Colin Miller. Hey, Colin.
Hello, James. Hello.
Ah, lovely. Excellent stuff. It is Monday morning. We've got action from the weekend, midweek round scheduled, although asterisks galore surrounding the fixtures at the moment after we saw, of course, one game drop from the Premier League this weekend, the Brighton-Spurs game, also one from the Championship as well, and Villa and United among the clubs who've post-fixtures this weekend recorded positive COVID tests among their players and staff. What's the current situation as we sit here early Monday morning?
Well, yes, I mean, Spurs are saying, as it stands, things will go ahead. Conte's had them in. I think the first team area of the training ground isn't yet open, but there is an area of the training ground that is open and that they are using. So as it stands, that one will go ahead. But obviously, if they get any more positive tests this week, I think that is probably in serious jeopardy. And Manchester United and Dan's Villa have, you know, reportedly got issues as well. So I think it's probably going to be a case of wait and see, and these decisions are going to be made pretty late down the line.
Yep, Spurs due to be playing Leicester on Thursday night. Daniel, you're sounding remarkably fresh given your extraordinary weekend.
Yes, it's all an act, I'll be honest. I feel quite groggy this morning.
Daniel, for those who didn't know, and the piece actually I think is out on Tuesday, completed an 800-mile odyssey this weekend with Plymouth Argyle supporters and their away trip to Sunderland.
Yes. 21 hours on a coach.
Wow. There's the Proclaimers, and then there's Daniel Storey. If you were ever going to miss a day of Premier League while sat on a coach, there is an argument that Saturday wasn't a bad one to do. Let's just quickly check on the results and that. 14 Premier League goals scored across the Friday and Saturday. Half of them were penalties. Top three all needed goals from 12 yards to win. Man City 1-0 over Wolves, same for Liverpool over Villa. Chelsea needed two penalties in their 3-2 victory over Leeds. Meanwhile, it was a lone Ronaldo penalty for Man United at Norwich as they moved closer to fourth place. They're now just 1 point behind West Ham, who were held goalless at Burnley on Sunday. Arsenal bullied Saints 3-0, Leicester thumped Newcastle 4-0, Brentford beat Watford 2-1, and Palace ended Everton's brief flicker of resurgence with a 3-1 defeat at Selhurst Park. Loads of games scheduled midweek. We'll get onto those soon enough. But your top three then still separated by just 2 points. But now 8 points clear of the rest of the pack. Was there a little bit of kind of post-Champions League deflation for the sides that have been busy in Europe?
The annoying thing for me is that I decided on Saturday that I would stay in and watch three football matches. And they were all 1-0 penalty games. So it wasn't a weekend well spent. I thought Man City looked a bit groggy. I thought Liverpool, Salah wasn't quite up to his normal very, very high standards. So I think there is an argument that the Champions League played a part. I mean, it's quite bizarre that Salah played in midweek against Milan because they didn't really need him to. Yet he still seems to play every single game. It's as if they feel they must get every inch out of him before they get to the African Cup of Nations. But yeah, I think there is an argument to be made for that.
The games itself, if you look at the matches and you look at the results, you probably think this is a very mundane weekend of fixtures, but the actual individual games, they were all competitive in different ways, and whilst obviously you have the Champions League action taking its toll, I don't think it was necessarily a case that the teams were feeling the fatigue. I think it's just the time of the season when you've so many games so quickly that it's very hard to prepare for them individually in that sense from a tactical point of view. And teams like Wolves, City and Villa, Liverpool are teams who can set up very well. And obviously Leeds, Chelsea was a different story. But each of those matches obviously decided by those sort of subjective penalty decisions. And I guess that there was quite a lot of narrative in that sense. And the games could easily have sort of swung, and any of those teams could very easily have dropped points this weekend.
Well, let's start our roundup at Anfield, which, beyond the action on field, had the off-field excitements of Steven Gerrard returning, clapping the crowd, all that kind of thing. Subdued but respectful recognition of the relationship. That guy. Did it tickle your Stevie G back at Anfield bingo boxes, Daniel?
Yes, it did. In that they ultimately didn't win the game, but they put up enough of a fight and were defensively resilient enough, I think, that he probably improved his case. And Gerrard's been trying to move away from that kind of sense that he's preordained to replace Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool. But he gets to do that because everyone else is saying it, so he can kind of quietly get on with his job. And he's made Villa a very difficult team to beat. I don't think they deserved to get anything out of the game on the balance of play. That Liverpool had far more shots and had far more, you know, territory and possession. But ultimately, they aren't getting outclassed in games anymore. The games that they are losing to Manchester City and Liverpool were tight, and they seem capable of beating any other team. And that's a pretty good recipe to finish 7th or 8th this season.
Stephen did score a bit of a zinger on Michael Owen post-game. Don't know if you saw that, when Michael Owen, who was back in the studio, said, I always hated going back to Anfield. And Stevie G replied, well, if I'd played for Man United, I would do too. Followed by nervous chuckles. Dan, no shots at all on target from Villa?
No. But I've seen more than enough across the five games. But like Daniel says, the two games against Manchester City and Liverpool were very, very competitive. Really, really unlucky not to get a point against Manchester City. Liverpool deserved to win on Saturday. I've no qualms with the result. I'm not sure about the penalties. I'm sure we're going to come onto them. But Liverpool were a different level. Steven Gerrard said it. Liverpool, they're an incredible side. The tempo in which they play, the way they press, the way they counter-press. The difference between watching them and watching Manchester City on Saturday, I thought, was quite stark. I know Liverpool are going to have problems with players going off to the Cup of Nations, but I just think they're an incredible side. And when they're full tilt, they are absolutely the best side in the league. Villa had a game plan. I think the defensive side of it in the main worked, but I think Steven Gerrard would have wanted us to be a bit more productive on the counter-attack, but we never really managed to make it happen at all, and that's the way it goes sometimes. But yeah, Liverpool thoroughly deserved the win, just slightly debatable circumstances for the penalty, I would say.
I must admit, I thought that penalty was the least debatable of the ones on Saturday. I don't know if what anybody else thinks about that. So it was Tyrone Mings on Mo Salah.
Yeah, I think Villa have more of a case for maybe getting one of their own than that not being a penalty. I think they were all, as Colin said at the top of the show, they're all kind of subjective, which, when big clubs get subjective penalties en masse, it always kind of creates this sort of conspiracy theorist PL anon theory that there's big club bias. But the reality is that if your club has all the pressure and all the territory, you're more likely to get penalties. And I think it was more a case of that.
Right, not only take penalties, but score them as well in the case of Mo Salah. Now, successfully converted each of his last 15 penalties in the Premier League. That's the second longest streak in the division's history, just to put that in perspective. Matt Le Tissier, of course, with 23 consecutive ones. It's worth pointing out, because as Jurgen Klopp was saying afterwards, it's by no means a given that just because you get given a penalty, you're actually going to convert it. Right, Man City?
The most interesting part of this game for me is that, again, it was another clean sheet for Liverpool, and Aston Villa didn't really have an attack throughout it, but Thiago was starting. And in the 8 matches that Thiago has started for Liverpool this year, they've only conceded one goal. And if you look at, obviously, the sort of first part of the season when he was out injured and he had a couple of fitness issues, they conceded two or more goals in 6 different games. So since his reintroduction to the team, they have become so defensively solid. And it's interesting because Thiago isn't the sort of typical player you think of in that sense, but I guess it shows that that those individual players, who obviously have the ball retention, but they also have the sort of positional awareness to sort of keep that midfield nice and compact to protect the defence, because when you sort of look at Jurgen Klopp's teams, the central midfield doesn't really do much in terms of creativity or in terms of adding sort of goal-scoring threat, although Thiago does that as well. It's more a case of they're there to provide the sort of shield for the back two, and so often earlier in the season, Liverpool had looked a little bit vulnerable like that, especially in their 3-2 defeat at West Ham, whenever there was constant counter-attacks going through the midfield, and that was a real danger for them. But they seem to have solved that very quickly. And I mean, Aston Villa are a team who've got attacking threat and very good attacking players, but they just weren't able to create anything throughout the match. And that's sort of been a trend in recent Liverpool games where they really have a lot of control over that. And again, it's that sort of side of things that is most impressive for me at the minute.
Well, a 1-0 win for Liverpool then, although Klopp was defeated post-game in his press conference, thusly.
Your thoughts on how Villa lined up today and how Villa played? I'm the opposition reporter. Just your take on Villa today for me, please.
Sorry, what?
How did Villa play today?
How did Villa do?
Dan, do you get that a lot?
I do an awful lot of podcasts. I often find in the comments there might be some little digs at the Birmingham accent. I don't feel like it's the most fancied accent across the country. I also feel like it's quite rare that you hear people within football with this accent talking on podcasts and stuff. So I do feel like it comes with a little bit of heat, the Birmingham accent. But as I said at the top end, I know that journalist, Ashley Price, and I can barely understand what he says because he talks at 100 miles per hour. He's almost right. The equivalent of the way Klopp plays football, but in which the speed in which he talks... Unbelievable. Right. So I can completely understand why Jurgen Klopp didn't understand a word of what he said. But yeah, I think he was just a bit nervous talking to someone like Klopp.
Right. I must admit, and I don't want to sound, you know, anyway, but I think I think the Brummie accent confers a certain niche appeal, you know, beyond the obvious delights that you bring anyway. But I revel in the rich... In the rich, is it a draw? I'm not sure, but the deep twang of your vowels and consonants.
I thought Peaky Blinders was going to put the accent on the map, but the problem is the accents on Peaky Blinders aren't very good.
Are they not?
So I think everyone now has a false perception of what the Brummie accent should sound like.
Right. Which is the sexiest accent by your definition?
Probably Irish, I would say.
Would you say?
Yeah. Irish or Edinburgh, Scotland, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely not Birmingham.
But it's coming, I think. I mean, Scotland has held its own in the broadcasting arena for so long. Anyway, there you go. Liverpool are worthy winners, I think we can agree, on Saturday. Did Chelsea and City get away with one? City had that 1-0 victory over Wolves. Groggy, I think you called them, Colin. A Wolves down to 10 men after Raul Jimenez was Jimenez to his own team. Extraordinary moment, that. The first booking, perhaps a little unfair. The second one, sheer madness.
I think the second one obviously just sort of came out of frustration, though, in the sense that he was trying to block the quick free kick. And I mean, obviously this was a very silly thing to do. But the first booking was very harsh. And I mean, I saw the opinion that there could have been a bit of common sense almost from the official not to sort of send him off straight away. And that kind of ruined the game from a spectacle point of view even more so. I mean, like, he only had himself to blame. And I think Jimenez, like, realised as soon as he'd done it, like, he took so long to leave the field. I think he was just very, very annoyed at himself. I don't think Wolves can have too many complaints over that. Although, what I would say, and I know I said earlier that a lot of these penalty calls were subjective, I think the penalty that Man City got in this game was the wrong call. I know there was a still that showed it hitting Joao Moutinho's sort of armpit and the top of his side rather than his arm, and I think it's because his arm is up in the air, and it sort of, from the first sort of angle you saw it kind of go, because his arm's up, it must have hit it, but it didn't upon the replay, and I thought that was very harsh. I actually thought City could have had a penalty in the first half for the Max Kilman. It was about a minute or two after the red card, and he was sort of leaning in there, and it hit the top of his shoulder area, and I kind of thought, again, it's these sorts of calls that are very, very much this season, they're instructed to be like, well, you know, use your discrepancy at the time, and you're sort of ruling it against the on-field decision as well. But I thought, whilst Wolves were pretty much against the cosh for the entire match, the way in which they lost this was quite quite unfortunate.
Dan, you mentioned the fact that City will have fewer people heading off to Africa Cup of Nations, but their form at home has been a little bit shaky of late, no?
Yeah, after the Southampton game at the start of the season, I remember that was that 0-0, if I recall correctly. They've had a couple of dodgy games at home. They're such a good side, but they almost become a bit robotic in games like that. And if the goal doesn't come early, they do at times struggle to open teams. Wolves have been very, very good defensively for the majority of the season, so they're one of the harder teams to break down in the Premier League. So from that point of view, I do understand it. But I just look at the difference in, like I said, in the way Liverpool play at home and the way Man City play at home. There's a tangible difference there that I think will come with advantages for Liverpool as the season goes on. But Man City, again, they did enough to win the game. It'll just be the circumstances in which it came that will frustrate the Wolves fans. The Jimenez thing changed the game. I will say his first yellow card came within like a flurry of when people had been booked for similar things. So although on the face of it, you look at that yellow card and think it's incredibly harsh, the way the game was set and the way the last 5-10 minutes had been, the yellow card was probably fair. And then to do what he did afterwards is absolutely mindless. And then to have the audacity to clap the Wolves fans as he walked off, I'd be fuming if I was sat in that away end, because you've just ruined their day, essentially, and you're clapping them as you walk off.
Madness. All right, well, Man City are at home again midweek, circumstances permitting. They'll be taking on a Leeds side held together by sticky tape. Daniel, who, despite that, gave Chelsea a real game of it Saturday afternoon, taking the lead indeed at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, it was a good response from Leeds. There's no doubt about that, because they were missing Calvin Phillips, they were missing Patrick Bamford again, they were missing Rodrigo, and it goes on and on. Pascal Struyck would have played centre-back, Bielsa said before the game, and he again got injured on Friday in training, so that's becoming a huge issue. But Bielsa has clearly realised that Chelsea are having defensive issues at the moment, so they really pressed high at the pitch. They weren't unlucky on their penalties, I don't think. I think both were penalties, just kind of lapses in concentration when Chelsea pushed on. But if Leeds can take any kind of heart from losing at the moment, given where they are in the league, then they certainly will from this.
Heartbreaking, though, to concede that second penalty. What was it, 4 minutes into time added on?
Yeah, it was one of those challenges. It was very similar to Troosty Kong's on Friday night against Brentford, in that you can just see in players' minds they're constantly told to keep calm, level-headed, and yet in the last minute of games you do start to panic and you do have a tendency when you're tired to dive in and make silly mistakes, and that's exactly what both did.
Chelsea's defensive problems have been amply cited, and of course the absences that contribute to that. Tuchel as well suggesting that the players that are on field haven't been putting in quite as much effort and intensity of late.
One of the interesting things I thought he said after the game was kind of, we played as if we had something to lose, which I think you can probably kind of extrapolate to Chelsea as a whole, because they were brilliant last season under Tuchel in the Champions League, where nobody really thought they'd win it until they got close. And then in the Premier League, they kind of surged from where Lampard left them and then almost choked it at the end of the season. So I think that's the kind of next step for Tuchel's Chelsea, is they do look a little bit panicked now when, you know, they are expected to be title challengers. It almost reminds me of that Jose Mourinho little horse missive when he was in charge and wanted to kind of completely downplay the expectation and pressure on the players, because they are playing as if there's a little bit of pressure on them now.
I was just going to say, do you think there's almost been too much rotation at Chelsea now, where they're now struggling to get a settled rhythm? Because it does feel like the 11 changes completely every game. And when you're making constant changes in the defence, I know they've got a few injuries at the moment, it can sometimes lead to a bit of disorganisation. And they've gone from having the best defence to, I think, they're now that they've conceded in the last 3 or 4 games, and that they look a little bit all over the place at times. So I don't know whether there's almost too much rotation at Chelsea.
8 goals conceded across their last 3 in all competitions, but a lot of that due to the Tuchel's hands being forced by injuries and that.
The other thing I think about Chelsea is that they have 4 defenders out of contract coming up this summer, and the longer those situations are prolonged, the bigger a problem that becomes. And I think the big one's Antonio Rudiger, who, well, certainly a lot of the noises coming out of Madrid and the Spanish press at the minute are that Real Madrid are in advanced talks to complete his signing as a free agent next summer, and that would be a massive, massive loss for Chelsea. And Cesar Azpilicueta is out of contract as well, and I know that Barcelona, despite their financial problems, have been sniffing around him, and then obviously Thiago Silva and Christensen, and okay, there's probably one or two of them will renew in the coming weeks and months, but that is an issue that they've got, that when you've so many players in a particular position who are coming to the end of their contract, and it's almost like they have the power in the renewal process. And we've talked a lot about how well run a club Chelsea have been, and you look at the sort of squad and the youth players they've got coming through is magnificent, but it always seems to be that they have players who seem to be less than happy at what they earn, and then that tends to lead to these contract negotiations being played out. And I wonder if that's another issue that's kind of in the background now that might be playing into individual form and collective form as well.
Colin, I keep seeing Barcelona linked to signings. This Monday, for example, Erling Haaland, for example, who I'm sure would be a fine addition to their squad. How is it? Is it just journalists kind of taking a year or two to catch up with the reality that even though they're called Barcelona, they have absolutely not even a pot to, you know? Or is there some secret fund that they've got? How is it that they... Is there any realistic possibility of a club that wasn't allowed to make any signings last summer, or register the players that they had brought in, rather, suddenly becoming active again?
It's a really, really bizarre situation in the sense that they are completely completely skinned. They really don't have any money. In fact, they do need to sell players. But at the same time, the flip side of that is that they are speaking with Ferran Torres, who wants to join them from Manchester City. He's not particularly happy there. And you kind of think, well, that's a player who you would imagine has a transfer valuation of, what, 60, 70 million? You know, right. There is absolutely no way Barcelona can afford that. But the situation that they have is that Barcelona as a club and the president Joan Laporta are very keen to talk up the possibility of them having this financial power and this ability to do these maneuvers, as he calls it, in the transfer market, which does seem pretty fanciful. But at the same time, this is a president and a club who are willing to take out multiple long-term loan deals with banks, which obviously solves a lot of the short-term issues and then gives them that little bit of wriggle room to spend. And at the end of the day, they are still Barcelona in the sense that this is a club who will appeal to a lot of players who are from Spain, who might think this is maybe like a challenge that we can accept to sort of go to this club and kind of be the player to help turn the situation around. But yeah, I mean, talk of players like Haaland and players with those sorts of valuations is totally unrealistic, probably okay. For the next several years.
Right. No, I understand that there are sporting challenges at Barcelona that, you know, some players might even find enticing. But the sheer fact that they weren't even able to register players last summer does suggest that a lot of this might be, as you say, posturing and that. Anyway, all very interesting. Champions League sides not particularly splendid this weekend, but getting through with a penalty. Also included Man United, who Saturday tea time were away at Carrow Road. Cristiano Ronaldo sorting this out for them from the spot. This was a second straight clean sheet for Ralph Rangnick in his second Premier League game in charge. It's pretty good. The tackling stats were way up as well. Yeah. Everything proceeding to plan, Daniel?
Well, look, they've won consecutive league games 1-0 for the first time in, I think, 5.5 years. And Rangnick will be happy with that because he's mentioned it before that the amount of shots United were facing, I think they were about 14th in the league when he took over for shots faced, which for a club of their magnitude is nonsense. And he has sorted that. But this was far more Solskjaer Manchester United than it was Ralph Rangnick Man United on Saturday because they weren't very good. The pressing, I mean, if it was there, you really had to look for it. And the whole point of Rangnick's pressing game is it should be very obvious from minute one, and it simply wasn't there. He said the intensity wasn't there. And they were really careless with the ball as well. I thought Norwich were good for a point. You can generally tell Manchester United's form by how David De Gea plays, and he was their best player at the weekend. And Rangnick was pretty stinging, and maybe that's good, you know, winning when playing badly, cliche klaxon, but it was Norwich and they were poor.
Midweek, Norwich are going to be facing Aston Villa. All right, Daniel, Dean Smith up against his former side. That's at Carrow Road, isn't it?
Yeah, Carrow Road on Tuesday.
All right, so no homecoming there. Meanwhile, Man United, COVID tests permitting, will be at Brentford. Last time they faced Brentford in any competition was 1975. They haven't faced them in the league since April 1947. Wow.
I was just going to say on Man United that obviously this is the start, or the Crystal Palace game was the start of a run of fixtures where it's 13 league matches, which is over a third of the season, and they only play one team that is currently in the top half, and that's West Ham at home in that run of matches. So that's a really incredible run. I think Brentford maybe, did they get into the top half after this weekend's win? Incredibly kind run of fixtures. Now, obviously, you know, that means that at the end of the season they're going to have a particularly tough run in, but it It does mean that Ralf Rangnick does have a period of 3 months of a time, especially when there's no Champions League action as well, where you can really get into a run of performances and results that can he can take the momentum into that final run of matches.
Mm. By the way, Colin, I'm sorry, nobody mentioned the Northern Ireland accent. I'm not quite sure what happened there when we were discussing the sexiest lilts
I thought it went before saying, but...
Yeah. Right, right. Of course, we all forgot you even had an accent. Then I just reminded them. When, Red Devils are now just a point off the top four. So, looming ominously. And more on all of that kind of thing next, along with details of Daniel's Homeric odyssey to the Stadium of Light and back.
Hello, 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 listeners.
How are you?
You may well have nodded off in the past by the time myself and Charlie get to talk odds, and if that's the case, let me reintroduce myself. I'm Carl Monaghan from Paddy Power, and I'm delighted to say that I've wormed my way into an earlier section of the show in order to massage your ear canals with my dulcet tones. You'll be getting all the latest odds from me based on what the football experts have just debated. Now to look ahead to this Norwich game against Aston Villa on Tuesday. This game sees Stevie G lock answers with his predecessor Dean Smith. He'll be desperate to show his former employers that they acted too hasty. This game won't be an easy one for Aston Villa though, as the Canaries, despite their loss last weekend, were added to the long list of clubs to make Man United look ordinary this season. Norwich are 11-5 to grab the 3 points, the draw is 9-4, and the Aston Villa win is 5-4. But just how good Gerrard is in the dugout is yet to be determined. We know he's good, listeners, but just how high is the ceiling? It's certainly early days in his management career, and Klopp still runs until the summer of 2024. But remember, the Paddy Power traders, listeners, sleep with one eye open. We make Stevie G the 6-4 favourite to be the next permanent manager at Liverpool. You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. T's and C's apply. BeGambleAware.org. And remember, take time to think.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Daniel, the longest journey facing any fans in the Football League this season is an 800-mile round trip from Plymouth to Sunderland, or vice versa. You did it this weekend. Crikey.
Yes. Yeah, I did, yeah. I kind of wanted to obviously tell the stories of some fans who make that journey. Plymouth are an exceptional football club because their shortest away round trip this season is 315 miles. To Cheltenham, and most of them are far more than that, double that. They're the most remote Football League club in the country, and therefore it's a huge undertaking they make every fortnight. And they took nearly 1,000 fans to Sunderland at the weekend and back. And yeah, it was 21 hours from start to finish. 4:30 on Saturday morning, we met outside the ground, and we got back at... Well, I got to my hotel at 2:30 on Sunday morning, so 22 hours later.
And of course, you had to get to Plymouth to even start this journey from
Midlands. Yeah, do you know, the thing is, I thought that was a kind of little badge of honour that I could just sort of casually drop in on the coach to a couple of people. And the lads I was sitting directly next to, we were chatting and I said that, and they said, yeah, but the thing is that we live in Camborne in Cornwall, but there's no Football League teams in Cornwall. So what they'd had to do is get the 10 p.m. train on Friday night to Plymouth, then spend 4 hours sat outside Home Park in Plymouth waiting for the bus to then go to Sunderland. So even that, they kind of do you on loyalty. So yeah, you haven't got a leg to stand on. They are a phenomenal set of supporters. They really are. I'm not just saying that because I spent the weekend with them, but it's a huge undertaking every season. I think they travel something like 3,000 miles more than any other set of away fans every
right.
season.
Well, famously, everybody hates a tourist. So what was the reaction to you kind of dropping in on their kind of away day hell?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they were probably suspicious at first, but they were lovely people. They just wanted to talk about how much they love Plymouth Argyle and how much they love following a team that demands kind of a greater loyalty in terms of time and money than other clubs. And they were really, you know, they're a good club. They're a club that looks after the supporters, which is necessary when they're travelling
right.
that far.
Are you now an Argyle fan? Were you kind of dragged to the back of the bus for some weird initiation?
No, everyone was very, very sleepy on the way back. But
right. What about on the way going? I mean, what did they do for all those hours on a coach?
Do you know what? They just repeat the same conversations you'd have in a pub about your football team. They talk about team selection and they talk about... It's nonsense, really. I'd like to say the time went quickly, but it didn't really. There's a thing with the Southwest that everyone who lives outside the Southwest gets, which is that you assume it's sort of Bristol and then a little bit more. And then you're on the coach for 3 hours and you've only just passed Bristol and you think, yeah, it's a bigger country than I thought.
Right. All that way. And Plymouth were 2-0 down after just 13 minutes.
Yeah, they were absolutely wretched in the first half an hour. And it should be said, 3 days before the game, their manager walked out to go to Preston. So they've appointed Stephen Schumacher, who was his assistant, as the new manager. So, they were top of the leagues 5 weeks ago, and now they're sixth and clinging on to a playoff place, and which just makes it, the sort of groans in an away end when you've travelled for 9 hours and your team has conceded twice in 13 minutes is something else. But the piece is going to be out on Tuesday. I wanted to do a kind of long read about their connection with the club and the kind of things in English football that are worth cherishing at a time when there's a lot of kind of grim news about Super League breakaways, etc.
Indeed so. Well, fantastic stuff. Look forward to reading that. Let's move on anyway to the midweek games. Man United supporters, hopefully we'll be getting on coaches for their long trip to Brentford. It's about, an hour around the M25 from Surrey. That's on Tuesday, as is Norwich's game with Aston Villa. Man City will be taking on Leeds. Leeds actually won this fixture last season. In fact, Marcelo Bielsa, one of Pep Guardiola's managerial heroes, took 4 points off Pep's side in the last campaign. On Wednesday, you've got Brighton against Wolves, Burnley, Watford, Sean Dyche up against his old club, Crystal Palace against Saints, who have won 5 of their last 8 league visits to Selhurst Park, and Arsenal against West Ham. And by contrast, David Moyes hasn't won any of his last 17 visits to Arsenal. Then on Thursday, Liverpool against Newcastle, Chelsea, Everton and Leicester Spurs. Again, fingers crossed on that one. Thursday night football for Leicester and Spurs, which they'll be used to, of course. And this coming a week on from their Europa and Europa Conference exit. Spurs, it looks likely by default, after they cancelled their game with Rennes because of COVID positives. Leicester, after their defeat in a thrilling match in Naples, which meant that they're in the draw, which is this Monday morning, for the Europa Conference playoffs. As Brendan Rodgers commented, I don't even know what that competition is. I mean, he does, surely.
Got to be honest, I'm not clear what it is myself.
The Europa Conference?
I just don't get it. I don't know. What's the point?
Well, that's a different question.
Yeah.
One which you could extend to kind of pretty much every activity in life, I guess. But I'm feeling like if you're in a Europa League group with the risk of dropping down to something called the Europa Conference League, you probably know what that is. Brent Rodgers, he's possibly not the most focused on Europe. He doesn't have the best of records, does he, in terms of Continental Cup things? Yeah.
His record is really, really poor. I mean, when you look at the sort of teams he's had, obviously he had a time at Liverpool when he made no advancements in Europe, and then at Celtic and now at Leicester. And you kind of think that group that they didn't get out of, and it's a little bit deceptive because obviously Napoli have been flying this season in Serie A up until the past month or so. But last week they had so many players unavailable or injured. It was almost a second string team, and they were 2-0 down within 15 or 20 minutes at the start of the match, and then to come back and then to lose it again. And it's been a recurring theme of Leicester this season. They think they've now conceded 40 goals across all competitions, and that is just far, far too many. And yes, they are missing Wesley Fofana, who got that horrible long-term injury in pre-season, but they have the fitness problems over Johnny Evans and then Kaglar Tuanchu, who's come in, and he just seems very error-prone. But I think it's more the sort of structure that Leicester have defensively has been very, very weak and very vulnerable this season. And you keep seeing it again and again, that they're vulnerable from set pieces, they're vulnerable on counter-attacks, and there's just too many individual errors. And for a team who, yes, they do have talent going forward, but I don't think they've got quite enough of an attacking threat to compensate for having such a leaky defence. And Sunday's win over Newcastle, I think, was their first clean sheet since the start of the season. So it's something that they really need to build on.
Only the second win in the last seven in the league as well. But I guess, answering a lot of the charges that you lay at their door, albeit against Newcastle. 4-0 Sunday afternoon. James Maddison shining once again, continuing his recent resurgence.
Brendan Rodgers, for all his inability to spot set-piece defending problems, he knows what to do with James Maddison, which is that when he plays well, you bring him off after between 80 and 83 minutes and let the Leicester crowd kind of give him their adoration, and he kind of looks around hugely happy, and then you give him a massive bear hug and tell him he's brilliant and he'll probably be good again next game. That's the kind of the 2+2=4 stuff with Maddison. They're just playing him and getting him back into form. And even Youri Tielemans was kind of keen to point the crowd towards Maddison when he set him up for the goal. And they are delighted to have him back firing again.
Leicester looking exceptional in this game. 4 goals, most of them pretty special as well. Patson Daka playing up front in place of Jamie Vardy. And mind you, as I say, albeit against Newcastle, they're now up to 34 goals conceded in their 16 matches so far. And this before they travelled to Anfield on Thursday.
They're finished, Newcastle. They'd needed to get some form of momentum after that initial first win. And it almost looks now like that the big celebrations, the big social media posts were just because that's going to be their only win of the season. you need to get some momentum after that. And if you're going to Leicester, they probably would have fancied themselves on the break against Leicester, because Leicester have conceded a lot of goals, to not score against one of the most unorganised defences at this point now. They needed to get something, and I think they're finished.
Wow. As I say, Anfield on Thursday, which could be interesting. Unlikely to be 4-3, you're suggesting, Dan?
Very unlikely, I would say. Yeah, I'd be shocked if they had a shot on target after Villa didn't manage one.
Is that the fixture with the greatest kind of disconnect between perception and what actually happens regularly on the basis of those two games from the 90s?
Well, funny you should say that, and segueing into the dullest game of this weekend, but I saw on Twitter that Burnley-West Ham 0-0 was the first time that game has been 0-0 in 72 meetings, which, right, given that I assumed it happened probably one in every two or three times they met, is quite impressive.
It's the Paddy Power Football Supporters Support Line. We're talking to Burnley fan Graham. What's up, Graham?
Well, it's Christmas, Paddy.
Not a Grinch, are you, Graham?
Oh, I love all the midweek fixtures, the quick turnaround between games.
So why so glum?
Well, it's the work Christmas party, the five-a-side drinks, schoolmates, dinner. Makes it very hard to watch all the football.
The Premier League is non-stop this December, so make the most of it with Paddy Power's Bet Builder offer. Get money back as a free bet if one leg of your Bet Builder lets you down. Paddy Power! Pre-match online Bet Builder bets only. Min odds 1 to 5 per leg. Min 4 plus legs. Max free bet £10 per day. Excludes enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Other big winners of the weekend beyond Leicester included Arsenal with their 3-0 win over Saints, and Palace with a 3-1 victory over Everton, ending Palace their 3-game losing streak and recording their first home win over Everton for 27 years. Wow. Lots of love here for Conor Gallagher, who got a brace. He's now on 6 goals and 3 assists. In fact, Duncan Alexander pointing out that he's got as many league goals this season as Harry Kane, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Lionel Messi combined. Extraordinary. However, Daniel, digging a little bit deeper, there's somebody else who perhaps deserves the accolades from the Palace fans.
Yeah, I thought Will Hughes played really well, making his first start for Palace. They've been demanding he plays instead of Luka Milivojevic for a while, because Milivojevic's his legs aren't quite there when he doesn't have James McArthur next to him, who got injured and is going to be out for a while. And I just thought Hughes is the one that enables Gallagher to go forward and stay forward, not have to do this kind of box-to-box thing, which means that later in the game he looks fresher and is able to do more and not kind of look tired for 65, 70 minutes. So that has to be the way forward for Vieira, I think.
Meantime, for Everton, who had beaten Arsenal in the previous match, they kind of resumed their slump. They're now on 1 win in 10 Premier League games. Unhappy scenes, the supporters chanting about Rafa Benitez after he took Richarlison off for Rondon. Rondon, who did actually get his first Everton goal, which didn't seem to help very, very much. The situation there, I mean, Dan, you're calling Newcastle has finished. How do you feel about Everton?
There's a lot going on at Everton at the moment, isn't there? A little bit too much. There seems to be a lot of distractions. The Luca Digne stuff, they can't afford for things like that at the moment. And Benitez hasn't got enough credit in the bank or any credit in the bank to be able to pull manoeuvres where you're leaving out one of their best players based on some form of fallout. They just can't be doing stuff like that. They obviously missed Dominic Calvert-Lewin. He's a huge miss. The Richarlison, even him being substituted, looked a bit bizarre that he felt he could stay on, but Benitez and the medical staff felt otherwise. There just seems to be a massive disconnect between all aspects of the club at the moment, that there isn't really anything you can say that's going well at Everton. So they're going to be very, very likely to be sucked into some form of relegation battle this season.
When you say the medical staff, they've already had the team doctor fired after some form of disagreement there this season, along with Marcel Brands also making way of late. So, yeah, a lot of issues there. Not least, you mentioned Dominic Calvert-Lewin's absence, but Rafa used to be famous for at least organising a defence. And that seems to have completely gone out the window at Everton.
But I think whenever you look at the career of Benitez, and yeah, he has this track record of organising defences, but that was always what people said about Jose Mourinho as well. And you sort of look at the kind of how his career has gone in the past 5 or 6 years. And what happens is whenever you have these sort of evolutions, I suppose, in coaching and tactics, it's the methods that worked maybe 10 or 15 years ago aren't quite as successful now. And Benitez always had this reputation as somebody who was never much of a man manager. He was always somebody that prioritized, you know, his sort of tactical setup, and he didn't really have time for sort of close relationships with players. And whilst that's something that might have been more successful previously, I'm not really sure that will work now. And you look at how quickly the relationship, which inevitably, I guess, broke down between him and the Everton fans as soon as results started to go a little bit wrong. But when you look at the relationship between him and the players, certainly from the sort of optics of it, of how it comes across with the Luca Digne situation, and then with how Richarlison reacted to being substituted yesterday, that, you know, you almost have players who look like they're in open dissent and who don't really look like they believe in what they're being sent out to do. And it's almost a little bit strange, because last Monday's victory over Arsenal, they almost seemed to feed off the energy of the crowd, and the crowd stayed behind the players in that game. And like, it was a very good performance, and Everton, despite having to get a last minute winner, they were a cumulative inch away from scoring 4 goals in that match. They really took Arsenal apart for large parts of that match, and it was a really encouraging performance. But then just to slip back into Sunday's defeat, which was almost like a performance of nothingness. You know, it was like you kind of knew that Crystal Palace were going to take the lead, and Everton just didn't really have a response to it. And it's just so disappointing in the sense that Everton have spent so much money, but they're such a badly run club, and it's just really not good enough for a team that has the caliber of players they have to be so disorganised.
I think Seamus Coleman is often now acting as the mouthpiece of the club, because they're obviously, Everton fans aren't going to hear what they want from Rafa Benitez. No one else at the club in the hierarchy is really saying anything. So he looks like he's carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders. He's making mistakes, a lot of mistakes. He made one the other week. It was against Liverpool at Goodison. And that goal at the end against Crystal Palace, I think he's tried to kick the ball against a Crystal Palace player, got it wrong, and they've ended up scoring. I think the commentator on Match of the Day was quite kind, saying, oh, he's tried to play the ball forward and get them moving. He didn't. He's tried to kick the ball against the Crystal Palace player, missed, and Crystal Palace have ended up sealing the game. But he looks all over the place, and he's the club captain. He's been there a long time, and he will know that it's all a mess at the moment. And again, that's been reflected, like Colin says, on the pitch.
Crikey. They'll be at Chelsea midweek. Rafa can expect a warm welcome there, of course. As for Arsenal, beaten last Monday by Everton, they had a 3-0 win over Southampton. As ever, the Gunners turning it on when it really matters.
Yeah, I mean, it was an important win because of the kind of off-field circumstances immediately prior to the game, with Arteta saying that Aubameyang had been dropped for the second time for a disciplinary issue. He was also dropped before the North London Derby in March. And clearly the decision to give him a contract seemed bizarre at the time, seems even more so now. But the fact that Martinelli and Lacazette and Odegaard's now coming to the goals as well, it provides a mandate for Arteta to leave Aubameyang out. This isn't a case that you know, he is their best attacker anymore. So he has to come on and play when he's ready, which can kind of dilute the impact of any disciplinary action the club takes. So it was crucial in that regard. They're lucky to play a Southampton team that are, when they are bad, are, I think, probably the worst team in the Premier League in terms of defensive disorganisation. They're impossible to work out. It's only a month ago or 6 weeks ago they were winning 3 or 4 games 1-0, and now they look like they can't defend a cross or defend a ball into the box. They're bizarre.
Mm. So that first goal, the lovely 16-pass move for Lacazette's opener, was that down to Southampton basically being slightly more mobile training cones? Or?
Yeah, I was going to say, it looked like to me like a training goal. There's an argument not to put pressure on the ball higher at the pitch if that's your defensive plan, which is we'll sit deep and look to defend the ball when it's 30 yards from our own goal. But Southampton kind of played out that whole move without getting into the same postcode as the ball, basically. And that's poor.
Yeah.
It's almost hard to believe that it was only a year ago, pretty much this week, that Arsenal played Southampton in this midweek round of games, as it was a year ago. And I know it was slightly earlier in the season in terms of the number of games played, but Southampton had a chance. If they had have won at the Emirates last season at that point, they would have gone top of the league. And it ended up being a 1-1 draw, and you kind of thought, oh, Southampton are flying. And that regression in that space of a year, and again, as Daniel said, they're such a hard team to work out because they've got a sort of good core of players, but they've such a thin squad, and I think whenever things don't go right on the day, whenever they don't get their pressing game right and they don't get their structure just spot on, things tend to fall apart very easily for them. And I don't think they're really in the relegation mix, but it's just odd to think that in a year they've regressed that much.
What I take from that, Colin, is that anything you say on a football podcast around December of a season means absolutely nothing.
Yes. Yeah, no, but absolutely. But it's the thing that you do tend to leap into these judgments based on form in the first half of a season, and because you almost forget how long and a season is and how injuries and player absences can influence things and change it.
Dan, sorry.
I was just going to say, do you not think Southampton are in the relegation mix, Colin? I would have them as one of the three to go.
No, I wouldn't have them down there. I think whenever you look at the squads that Norwich, Newcastle at the minute and Watford have, I think Southampton have more individual quality. I think they've got more of a consistency across the pitch, and they're strong. Their starting 11, I think, is strong in all areas, whereas if you look at some of the other teams down there, outside of a couple of attacking players, they are a lot of them, you kind of think they could easily be teams who are in the Championship this season. I think so Southampton are just about will have enough to steer clear of that.
They're currently 5 points above the bottom three. So you're three to go down, Colin?
I would say Norwich, Newcastle, and I think Watford. Because right. I think when you look at Burnley's situation, they've only won once all season, but they're always just so hard to beat. And it only takes one or two matches for them to sort of get on this mini run and pull themselves away. And they've done it so often before. I've written them off too many times. I'm not going to do it again.
And you know who Burnley have this week? Watford. The team immediately above them on the other side of that dotted line. Extraordinary. Daniel, you're three to go down?
Yeah, boring, but the same as Collins. I do think Southampton are bad. And I don't think they'll be far above it. But I think Watford are probably the most controversial one of those choices. And that may well depend on whether Claudio Ranieri is still there in 2 months' time.
Because what?
Well, the last time they were in the Premier League, they sacked Kike Sanchez Flores after 10 games. Ranieri's had 9, and he's lost 7 of them. So it wouldn't be a huge shock if Watford lose to Burnley this midweek. It wouldn't be a huge shock if they made a change again, because that's what they do. And they look really poor defensively under Ranieri. They basically had a spell of about 15 minutes under his management where they scored 4 goals against Everton and 2 goals in stoppage time against Man United. Hmm. And outside of that, they've been absolutely dreadful. And there's been no obvious improvement. They're taking fewer points per game than they were under Cisco Munoz. They're having fewer shots. They're conceding more shots. So, I don't know. I feel like Ranieri might be sacked by February the 1st, which would be very Watford.
I think the nature of that defeat on Friday against Brentford as well is so damaging, because Brentford had quite a few players out. They were not playing well. And to be 1-0 up 7 or 8 minutes left and to go on to lose from that position, I think that's something that can really just knock the confidence and self-belief of players. And Watford, I think Watford are a little bit like Newcastle in this regard, and that they've got these 2 or 3 really good attacking players like Emmanuel Dennis, Ismaïla Sarr and Josh King, who are all in good form. But when you look when you look at the sort of defence in the midfield, they just haven't had enough investment in those areas, and they've almost tried to get by with signing players on frees or loan deals for minimal fees. And whenever you don't have that sort of cohesion there as well, they just seem like they're too easy to score against. Obviously, that's reflected in the numbers, but these are like Newcastle. You know, you can. It's almost like you can score as many goals as you want, but if you don't have that defensive structure in place, you can't get away with that over the course of a season, and you will be dragged down. And Watford and Newcastle have sort of healthy goals for numbers this season, but when you're conceding so regularly, you will get beaten by better teams, and that's just what's been happening.
Watford are the only team in England's top four divisions yet to keep a clean sheet this season. On the subject of nice numbers up front, quick shout from Manuel Dennis, who has now scored or assisted 12 Premier League goals this season. Only Mo Salah has more. So there's that. All right. Next up, speaking of things going down, we'll look back on the day there was that parachuting Santa.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. You're listening to the Totally Football Show, in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which will come in handy when Mikel Arteta finally bends the process altogether. Pre-match bet builders only get your stake back as a free bet, minimum 4 plus legs, and maximum free bet is £10. Other T's and C's apply, and please gamble responsibly.
It's Monday the 13th of December. Also with you today at some point will be the Solely Football League show with Derby defender Curtis Davis joining the team to discuss, well, the 5-5 draw between Oldham and Forest Green, I reckon, and probably some other stuff as well. Totally Football Show European edition. You have to wait till Tuesday for that, but it's worth that wait as we'll be looking back on the Champions League and Europa League playoff draw reaction thing. And also other things like Real Madrid, their 2-0 win in the Madrid derby and other stuff as well. A little bit more Spanish stuff with Colin in a second, but a shout out as well for the Athletic Women's Football Podcast, which is out on Tuesday, and they'll probably be all over the shock result of the season, Reading's 1-0 defeat of Chelsea. Michael Cox marvelling at this one. Great performance this, says Cox. He was not easily impressed. Fourth minute goal on the counter-attack from Reading. 86 minutes of fantastic last-ditch defending, including their 0-0 draw with Juventus last midweek. Emma Hayes' side have now had 59 shots in two games without scoring once. Crikey. Of course, the one strike that did find its target in last week's game against Juventus was Sam Kerr taking out the pitch invader, and everybody cheered. Except, Daniel, some striking news about that from the Met.
Well, yeah, but I mean, apparently it seems that the police can't charge a pitch invader entering the pitch at a women's game because it isn't classed as a designated football match, which, I mean, is clearly just a complete oversight, which will hopefully be changed very quickly, but is obviously absolute nonsense. On the Sam Kerr thing, when I initially heard about it, you kind of have an image of what that is, which was, I assumed, would be the supporter kind of trying to run onto the pitch and Kerr just kind of sort of stepping in their way to block them. It is far, far funnier than that. Because Kerr goes at a faster speed to make contact with the pitch invader than the pitch invader is going at. It's absolutely brilliant. It's as they're leaving the pitch and she just really barges, obviously taking out some frustration from the fact that Chelsea haven't scored, and gets a booking, which is well worth it. Well worth it.
Bodied him. That's how I've heard it described. She bodied him.
Yeah, she did. She did. And she did very literally do that, because she put her whole body into it. She almost left her feet to do it, which was great.
Magnificent. Well, as I mentioned, it is the 13th of December today. And as it happens, it was on the 13th of December 1998 that a young Dan Bardell was at Villa Park for a memorable, for good and less happy reasons, a match between Aston Villa and Arsenal. Villa were 2-0 down, Dan, and then came back to win 3-2 against the champions.
Yeah, I remember the game really well. I think it's one of those ones, if there hadn't have been the big Santa hitting the roof incident, you still would remember it, because it was a real famous coming back against Arsenal, from 2-0 down. I remember Bergkamp absolutely bodying Villa in that, right, in that first half. He was unbelievable, Bergkamp. My favourite ever Premier League player, and he took Villa to the cleaners pretty much on his own in that first half. But yeah, the famous incident that I'm sure you're going to describe better than me, James.
Well, no, I don't think so. You were there. I mean, we all chuckle at it when you say Santa hitting the roof, but it wasn't at all funny, as it turned out. This is former RAF flight sergeant Nigel Rogoff, who actually ended up losing a leg after crashing into the Trinity Road stand, dressed as Father Christmas, parachuting in as a charity initiative.
And it was a bit of a bizarre stunt, to be honest. Not the kind of thing I've seen at many football matches, and I'll probably never ever see it again now after what happened. But it's one of those ones where he almost didn't look like a real person coming down. I don't know what went wrong, but as he hit the roof, it didn't look like it was a real person. So the initial reaction from the fans is to go, "Hey!" And then suddenly you realise that it's a human coming down. And yeah, I'll never forget the way he hit that roof and then hit the floor. It was absolutely harrowing. Dear. It was horrible, horrible scenes. And you know, you're 2-0 down at the time and you think the game's just gonna go. The game's gonna get called off. You're not gonna see the teams out for the second half. But there was a real extended half time and Villa came out a different team. I've interviewed John Gregory on it before, and he decided that he was gonna make a substitution. He told Julian Joachim he was coming off. So Joachim had slipped his boots off and was just sat there knowing he wasn't coming out for the second half, and Stan Collymore was replacing him. But during the extended break, John Gregory changed his mind and decided to leave Joachim on. And then he ended up not coming off. Gareth Barry came off for Stan Collymore instead, and Villa went 4-3-3 instead of the five at the back that they were playing, and turned the game round and won 3-2. And it was a real famous comeback. But the nice end to the story is that the Nigel, who obviously the Santa that hit the roof, he ended up meeting his future wife that day. She was one of the paramedics. I've absolutely no idea if they're still married, but they certainly got married after that. So there was at least a happy ending to a horrible event.
Mm. Crikey.
Sounds like you've been duped by a live-action Christmas film, to be honest.
Yeah.
The Santa that hits the roof and meets the love of his life is like everything on Christmas 24 channel at the moment.
Yeah, everything that's on my Skybox that my wife records at the moment, it sounds like.
Nigel also subsequently took part in a 3,000-mile, so have some of that, Plymouth fans, 3,000-mile Atlantic crossing with a crew of other military veterans who nicknamed themselves the Legless Rowers. So well done for that. You say you don't often see that kind of thing. There was that incident last summer, though, of a... He wasn't quite a parachutist. He was more of a... He had a motor on his back and was doing the stunt for Greenpeace. And it came down, almost took out the press box in a similarly dramatic fashion at the game between France and Germany at Euro 2020.
Yeah, wasn't the parachute was like cut by... Was it like there was a wires at the top of the stadium where he came in? So the wire sort of cut off the parachute and it just went out of control as he entered the stadium, and he had to sort of like guide himself round, and he narrowly missed the start. The footage of that was incredible.
He was so close to the press box, he actually took out laptops on the way. Very, very dramatic. He thankfully did manage to, you know, ground himself safely. Anyway, there you go. Well, that's quite a memory there, Dan. Colin, meanwhile, I mentioned the 2-0 win for Real Madrid in the derby on Sunday night, which wasn't a huge surprise, and given Barcelona's issues at the moment, not that remarkable, I guess, that Real Madrid are in in front and 8 points clear at the moment. But I think what's causing a lot of comment in Spain is the identity of the two teams in the top three with them, Real Betis and Sevilla, the two Sevillian sides. And, you know, Craig, you're the man who wrote the book on Sevillano soccer. So is this something that's sustainable? Is it just a coincidence that they're both up there, or is there something special going on right now in Andalusia?
It's a bit of both. I think when we think of Sevilla and you think of six Europa League titles in the past 15 years and continued investment, especially in recent seasons, that it's no surprise they are certainly in the top four, if not slightly pushing on from that. I'm actually slightly disappointed with Sevilla this season, and not just because of their almost disastrous Champions League exit. They should have got through the group they were in, and they did underperform. But Sevilla's sort of successes, certainly in Europe in recent times, have come with this sort of high intensity and the fact that they kind of swarm teams and try to be aggressive and get on the front foot. But this season it's a little bit different. They almost seem like they're very defensively solid, but they're a little bit slow almost. Their central midfield is Fernando and Ivan Rakitic, and they're both midfielders now well under their 30s. And the tempo of the games they play at tends to work quite well in La Liga, which is maybe a little bit slower than say the European fixtures, and they tend to grind out a lot of wins, as they did this weekend. They won 1-0 in away the Athletic Club in Bilbao, and that was to be honest, it was a very undeserving victory. But they're grinding out these results, and they're sort of just about staying within touching distance of Real Madrid, although I don't know how long that's going to last. I think Betis is a much stronger story this season in terms of what they have done under Manuel Pellegrini, who was appointed 18 months ago. And he was appointed after they finished 5 points above the relegation zone. And in those sort of season and a half that he's been at the club, they've only spent a transfer fee on one player, Herman Petzela, the central defender, and that was only €3 million. Yet they are now third in La Liga. They finished sixth last season. They're into the knockout stages of the Europa League, and they're playing really, really good football. And Nabil Fekir and Sergio Canales are just two players who are very... They're fun to watch. Like they like to express themselves on the ball, and they're a team who take risks, who take chances in the final third, yet are defensively quite solid. And now they're just having this wonderful season. And on Sunday they beat Real Sociedad 4-0, and at halftime they had their sort of annual tradition now of inviting their 50,000-60,000 home fans to bring stuffed toys into the stadium to throw onto the pitch at halftime. And the sort of thousands of toys are then collected and sent off to children's charities over Christmas, which is a fantastic initiative. And I'm actually surprised it hasn't caught on a little bit more in terms of other clubs and other sports. But
although there was that pig's head thrown on once in Catalonia, I'm not sure if that was part of the same.
Yeah. Slightly different atmosphere, I think.
Right.
But the Betis halftime, it actually that event in itself almost created like a party atmosphere, and then Betis came out after the break and scored three more goals, and they're just in fantastic form at the minute. The thing about La Liga this season is that everybody, including myself, went into this being like, oh, this is going to be there might not be the most quality that the league's ever had, but it's going to be a really competitive title race. You know, it's going to go down to the wire again. And you're actually looking at it thinking, well, Real Madrid are the one team who are really, really doing very well and starting to pull away a little bit.
No, mind you, a year ago, you'd have said Southampton were flying and about to win the Premier League title. So who knows what could happen, Colin, between now and the end of this campaign. Crikey, there'll be more on the latest events in La Liga in, of course, Tuesday's Totally Football Show European edition. But I think that pretty much brings us to the end of today's show. Many, many thanks to Colin and Dan. And Daniel, and producer Charlie, and you listener. Join us again Tuesday and then Thursday as well, why not? And for now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.